planned. How about House Speaker Mike Johnson? Behold the art of the deal, Johnson said. President Trump has created leverage, brought many countries to the table, and will deliver for American workers, American manufacturers, and America's future. Never mind looming inflation or the decision of many multinational corporations based in China, like Apple, to stay there rather than return home or go to a third country. As usual, the great majority of Republicans in Congress refuse to criticize Trump. Many wince at the tariffs, and some, like Ted Cruz, actually call it, for what it is, a tax on consumers, but then go on to wish Trump well. Only about a half dozen Republicans back proposed legislation in the Senate, the Grassley-Cantwell bill, that would require the president to give Congress 48 hours notice of any new tariffs and require House and Senate approval within 60 days, or they would automatically be canceled. The bill doesn't have a ghost of a chance of making it to Trump's desk, where he would veto it anyway. Finally, there's Trump himself trying to show supreme confidence. On April 10th, he claims his administration was, quote, doing really well on our tariff policy. But neither he nor any of his cabinet members have been able to cite a single instance other than Vietnam of talks underway with foreign leaders or trade deals nearing completion. Fact is, there aren't any. No matter, Trump says they'll all come running to kiss his behind. No one around him dares say otherwise. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 15, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dave Johnson, Lexis Ponce, and Kenny. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in depth. I'm Lexis Bonse. A new book by tech reporter Owen Higgins looks at how new wealth has somehow managed to attract formerly progressive journalists into its orbit. The book entitled Owned: How Tech Billionaires on the Right Bought the Loudest Voices on the Left focuses on two once left-leaning voices who have shifted to the right, Matt Taibbi and Glenn Greenwald. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Higgins about his book.
So as far as Taibbi and Greenwald go, might they make the argument that what they're saying goes beyond traditional left-right politics, and what they're really talking about is elites versus non-elites?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way to put it. I think that they might frame it that way somewhat. I think that they might say that they are presenting a politics or a message that transcends left and right. They might kind of couch it in those terms, say that it's about free speech or anti-imperialism, but in reality, what they're doing is they are promoting and pushing forward the ideology of the far right as personified by the people who are funding the platforms that they use and, you know, in some cases directly paying them, in other cases taking actions to benefit them. You know, for two examples, I would say, you know, Peter Thiel and J.D. Vance investing in Rumble, and then Rumble hiring Glenn Greenwald to be a podcaster slash writer for them. And then in the latter case, I would say Elon Musk selecting Matt Taibbi to kind of, you know, pass on these curated Twitter files, so-called Twitter files, and to kind of use that for his own success. Both of these men also, you know, they do conferences, and they appear on they have other streams of income that are related to this kind of circle of tech billionaires, circle of wealthy Silicon Valley conservatives. But I would say that, yeah, you know, they would probably couch a lot of their politics in this kind of more ideologically appealing way, and maybe that's how they justify it to themselves. But I think if you look at the material reality of what they're doing, that becomes pretty hard to swallow.
Is this something similar to the Naomi Wolf situation? Naomi Klein kept getting approached by people who would confuse her with Naomi Wolf, and she decided to write a book about that because Naomi Wolf had shifted her views to the right. I think the book was called Doppelganger. And I guess you're familiar with that.
I am, yeah, yeah. I referenced Doppelganger in my book, and my reporting on Naomi Wolf is referenced in Doppelganger as well. So, yeah, I'm familiar with Naomi Wolf. I think that this is a case of someone whose beliefs have kind of gone off the deep end in a lot of ways, setting aside her anti-vax conspiracy theories. She has increasingly just kind of become a real crank. There's really no other way to put it where Naomi Wolf is at this point. So I would say there's a bit of a difference, at least between her and Greenwald, who is a more, I think, clever and more nuanced character than Wolf, where he, I think, would say if he endorsed any of the things that she was endorsing to the extent that he does, he kind of frames it as the right to have discourse or, you know, an expression of like state power trying to silence people from saying what they want to say. Taibbi is not like that. At this point, I think he's pretty much a conspiracy theorist as well. He shares a lot of Wolf's beliefs on vaccines and also kind of delves into this kind of paranoiac worldview when it comes to things like trans rights and increasingly this idea of liberal censorship, where Matt specifically seems to think that there is a liberal censorship industrial complex that's being run in the government, despite the fact that the government is almost wholly controlled now by the GOP. He somehow still believes that liberals and Democrats are able to silence people and to censor people using the levers of state power.
That's referring to the Biden administration, right?
It was a reference to the Biden administration, but he's still doing it. He's still saying that this stuff exists. He's still saying that it's a problem. He appeared in front of the House as a GOP witness to talk about all of these conspiracies about how, you know, the deep state is trying to silence people. And there's this somehow this federal and private sector conspiracy to silence the right.
So that's a reference to the attempt to censor or supposedly censor things because they negatively affected or they would negatively affect public health? Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, the public health stuff has been kind of one of his main sticking points. He's also talked a lot about the Hunter Biden laptop story that the New York Post wrote, and it was based on what at the time seemed to be kind of dubious intelligence. It turns out, like later on, that we found out that the laptop itself was real, but at the time wasn't quite clear. And so Twitter and Facebook, and I think a couple other sites decided to kind of preemptively kind of silence that link, the link to that story. I don't think that this was the right idea, by the way, but that is what they did. And that was their justification for doing it. To Matt, this kind of represents a conspiracy on their part to silence this story. I think that's debatable. I don't think that the documents that he released, even though they purported to tell the story, really do tell that story. I think that the story that they tell is a company that's trying to hedge its bets and trying to make sure that it takes the approach to this information that's going to be, I think, like legally correct. Because at the time, it wasn't quite clear on whether or not like the laptop was real. And from a journalistic point of view, you couldn't tell like where it came from, and you couldn't really assess like the chain of evidence, as it were. At any rate, this is, you know, one of Matt's big, this was the first Twitter file story that he reported out, and this, you know, purported to tell a story of a deep state working against Trump within the government that was, you know, working along, and the Biden the Biden campaign all working together with Twitter and Facebook to swing the election to Biden and to make sure that nothing bad about him would come out before voting started. I mean, this is honestly, like, really not, I think, based in reality.
And on foreign policy, there is a view that Trump is upsetting the foreign policy establishment. And so the idea is that he would lead the U.S. into a less interventionist position. There wouldn't be so much emphasis on regime change, let's say.
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting question. And this kind of, I mean, this kind of outside the scope of my book, which the narrative of which ends around like the early summer of 2024. But I would say that if you were really expecting Trump not to adopt a bellicose and frighteningly violent foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, I don't really know like how many times you have to fall for that one. That's just not the kind of foreign policy that he pushes forward. He does have a certain chaotic approach to foreign policy that I suppose from a certain point of view, you could say is positive for how it disrupts the established hard power and soft power of U.S. hegemony, global hegemony. But I don't think that this is a case where that's really going to happen. Trump is more interested in just using force. So to the extent that, you know, I think that they have, you know, whether or not they're this gullible, they certainly believe that their audiences are. You know, Glenn on Twitter and on his show has talked about how, you know, it's great that Trump, I think very briefly, like suggested offhandedly in response to a question that maybe they would cut the defense budget. Glenn jumped on this as evidence that it was going to happen. Of course, it wasn't. You know, and any cuts that were proposed by Hegseth that, you know, haven't even gone through, but only presented the option of kind of repurposing some of the funding to more Trump's priorities. Currently, I think it's pretty difficult to defend Trump's foreign policy from any kind of a left-aligned or libertarian perspective, considering that, you know, he's bombing Yemen, his treatment of pro-Palestine dissidents within the country, the relentless attacks on Gaza they have started once again with Trump's full approval, not to mention, you know, just his kind of general bellicosity when it comes to countries within the Western Hemisphere and beyond. I think that anyone who is trusting that a Trump administration is going to be any kind of positive difference to the prior Trump administration, to the George W. Bush administration, or honestly to the Biden or Obama administrations, is really just fooling themselves. You're mistaking something different for it being something good. You're mistaking this kind of upheaval that he's doing with the kind of upheaval that might make an actual difference in the end goals and end determining motivations for U.S. foreign policy. And that's just not the case. That's not going to be the case under Trump. That's not going to be the case, I think, under any president, but especially not under one who has been very, very clear that his priority is might makes right, and that's what he's going to do.
Have you noticed any instances in which Greenwald or Taibbi have criticized the Trump administration?
Greenwald has certainly pushed back on the deportation, or at least the stripping of visas of Mahmoud Khalil on student visas. He's pushed back on that. He's pushed back on bombing Yemen. He's pushed back on the continuing endorsement and full throttle backing of Israel's attacks on Gaza. I think that that's not a negative thing. Often, Glenn will kind of couch this in certainly a lot of his criticisms of people on the right over Israel and Gaza was like, you don't want to be like liberals. That was kind of his thing. You don't want to be like the left and be censorious, you know. So that was kind of an interesting approach. As far as Taibbi goes, I think there has been some stuff, but not much. I mean, he's a supporter of Elon Musk's so-called Department of Governmental Efficiency, or at least he's, you know, he's open to it being a good thing. He has, from the beginning of the war on Gaza, he has taken a soft pro-Israel approach. I think the most thing he said in the wake of the beginning of the bombing back in October, November 2023 was that professors shouldn't be telling their students what to protest as the protest movement was starting in colleges. He hasn't thought this too much. He's been like well, some things that they've done, but overall, it's pretty clear to me that Taibbi especially is all in on right-wing politics and all in on the GOP. And I think that's because he knows that at this point, there's really no going back for him. There's no way to kind of flip things around. He's going to be kind of stuck in this right-wing box forever. Greenwald, I think, is smarter, has always been smarter. And so he always kind of leaves himself a little room to hedge. So, you know, if he does end up needing to make a pivot, he's going to be able to do that. So I think Greenwald would be like a little more critical, even though he's obviously still at least, you know, whether or not he actually means it, he's certainly acting very gullible as far as what Trump is saying he's going to do. But, you know, I would say Taibbi is, at this point really seems to be a true believer.
Anything else you'd like to add to what you said?
I would just say that while Taibbi and Greenwald make up half of the book, the other half of the book is about right-wing tech billionaires like Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen, David Sachs. So those are the primary ones. And the book aims to not only kind of explain the last 20, 30 years in online journalism and kind of using Greenwald and Taibbi as a way of explaining that, but also hopes to kind of give a window into how Silicon Valley turned to the right and kind of why we are in the position that we are right now politically.
You know, I didn't even ask you about Tulsi Gabbard. Did you ever expect her to end up as director of national intelligence?
I don't know if I necessarily expected her to end up there. I expected her to have some position in the cabinet, though. For a while, I thought she might run for president or be his vice presidential nominee. But as a Republican, always. Her politics have always been pretty far to the right. Even when she was a Democrat, she kind of hedged on some stuff.
Seems like she's taken some decent positions on U.S. foreign policy.
She had some criticisms of U.S. foreign policy, but I would say that those were always kind of couched in a fundamental right-wing worldview, which has always been extremely Islamophobic.
She was identified with the Hindu nationalist movement in India, right?
Yeah, she's close with the far right BJP and the kind of ruling fascist government in India right now. She comes from a pretty far right family. For her to be in this position is not surprising. She's been in what I'm pretty sure is military intelligence for a long time. It's not surprising that she would join the administration. Her getting this position, I found a little surprising only because I didn't know if she would get approved or not. But the Republicans seem to be kind of willing to do whatever Trump says. What I was honestly surprised by was that like there weren't like some Republican defections and some Democrats kind of coming over to vote for her because she used to be a Democrat. I think her being in charge of intelligence is one of the scariest people to be appointed to anything in the Trump administration. She is far right. She has a very, very, I think, terrifying politics to me. And I think that anyone with her level of Islamophobia and her perspective on military action and how to deploy the U.S. military is something that we should all be very aware of. Her being in a position of power over U.S. intelligence agencies is something that should give all of us pause. And I'm not talking about these conspiracy theories about her being in thrall of Russia or any of that stuff. I'm talking about like the real stuff. The real stuff is that she's a far right extremist. And for her, and she has does not seem to have really any interest in pursuing a politics or pursuing policy that would respect people's civil liberties or civil rights. And for her to be in this position of power with her military background, with her stated kind of allegiance to this extremist far right agenda is something that should be concerning to everybody.
That was tech reporter Owen Higgins speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about his new book called Owned, How Tech Billionaires on the Right Bought the Loudest Voices on the Left. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Lexis Ponce. Thanks for being with us.
KBOO News in Depth. where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Kenny. Have you ever wondered what in Bend, Oregon may be weird, wonderful, or perhaps obscure? I spoke with Joshua Savage, author of Secret Bend, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure, to learn more.
What's going on?
Hello. My name's Kenny. Nice to meet you.
You too. Over the phone.
Yeah, nice to meet you over the phone. And I am interviewing you about your most recent book about locations in Bend, Oregon that are weird, wonderful, or obscure.
Yeah.
And I just had a couple questions regarding the book, which I did look through it, and I did enjoy a lot of what was in there.
Cool.
And I just wanted to ask, how did you find these locations?
Mostly just getting out and exploring on my own. This is my third book about Bend, and I mean, it's actually all of Central Oregon, so it's not just Bend, but I get out there and just kind of look around. I also ask a lot of people who have been here for a long time, you know. I did some volunteering at the visitors center for a little while, and so I had people coming in and just always talking to people. So a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that pretty much answered my next question, was if you got any help from locals.
Definitely.
I bet there was a lot of stories that could be told from the locals about the area.
Yeah, I mean, I do a column for our local paper. It's called Savage and Bend. And people send me all kinds of questions about the area, you know, a lot of history stuff, a lot of cultural stuff. And so a lot of times I'll go to the local museums, or I'll go through old newspapers, or I talk to a lot of those locals to help me answer those questions, because they've been here a lot longer than I have.
That is a good point.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to ask, how often did you get lost trying to find these locations?
There's a few of them. Like, there's ghost towns, and I took a road trip on my own. It was just me. My kids were in school and my wife was working. So I just went ahead and took about, I don't know, 4 or 5 days and just kind of went through Central Oregon looking for these ghost towns. And on a couple of those, I did get lost, and I wasn't able to find all the ones that I had set out for. But I've never gotten lost so badly where, you know, I couldn't find my way back eventually, you know.
Yeah. Well, with looking for a lot of these locations, you're bound to get lost at some point in one way or another.
Yeah. Or if nothing else, they're just hard to find because there's not really an address for some of them.
And yeah.
You can't put them in GPS.
Yeah, that's what makes the adventure a lot more worth it in my book.
Yeah, for sure.
And did your family help you with making this book at all?
Not this particular book. I mean, they give me some feedback here and there, and they were definitely with me when we went to some of these places, especially my wife, because we do a lot of hiking and, you know, just getting out and exploring. But they're teenagers now. You know, they don't have the hiking bug, and they're doing their own thing. We did write some children's books together when they were younger, but as far as this particular book, not so much. Just being with me sometimes.
Alrighty. And you did talk about caves quite often in your book.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to know, which one would you recommend just anybody?
Probably just to get started. You know, there's so many. And it's only open certain times of the year. I think it's late spring, maybe even early summer. But the one, Lava River Cave, that is probably one of the better ones, because it's, you know, it's on government property, and, you know, it's kind of, you have to get a timed entry, and there's other people in there, and it's, and one of the other things is it's super long. It's almost a mile that you can actually explore.
A whole mile?
Close to it, something like that. It's very, very close to it, and you can kind of just get in there, and, you know, I guess you're a little safer in there because there's other people kind of coming in and out. Some of these other ones are kind of off in the middle of nowhere sometimes, and I wouldn't say they're dangerous necessarily, but, you know, it does take a little more exploring to get to them.
Just a little more advanced knowledge to get in there.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Not a whole lot, really. I mean, some of them are easy to get to.
All right. And when you were making this book, how did you categorize with weird, wonderful, or obscure?
I just kind of picked on my own. I was like, hey, this is unique. You know, I haven't seen this anywhere else. You know, I've lived a lot of places, traveled a lot of places, and I think this really makes our region kind of distinctive, or is just a lot of fun, you know? And so I just kind of picked from there.
I did read a little bit about Klondike Kate, and that was a pretty nice section for me to read.
Yeah. She was an interesting, you know, figure in our history. I haven't, you know, of course, obviously she was well before my time, but, you know, you hear a lot about her. Somebody's even written a biography about her, and she kind of left behind a little bit of a legacy here. So kind of a local celebrity of her time, I guess.
That is actually a really good thing to include in the book, especially if she's a local figure.
Yeah, for sure.
It also just kind of shows the influence that encompasses, in a sense.
True, true.
All right. And are you always looking for new locations to look for or write about?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think it's just in my blood to get out and explore and do things like that. And I was telling you about that column I have for our local paper. That makes me get out, too, because people ask me questions and I have to get out and find these things. And sometimes they're tough. Sometimes I just can't answer them because I can't find enough information about them.
That is bound to happen sometimes.
Right.
And did you have any honorable mentions you wanted to add in the book? Like any locations that you were just like, not this one, but maybe another?
Probably. I mean, there was a couple that I really just couldn't find, I guess, factual information, or I couldn't really prove it true. And I've got a whole list of them, you know. I mean, there was one, for example, about supposedly we have a some kind of box buried somewhere, and it's got a lot of bins. It's almost like I forgot what you call them off the top of my head, but those little boxes you bury your treasure in and then go back and look for, you know.
Like little time capsules?
Time capsule, that's what I was looking for, yeah. But supposedly Ben had a time capsule, and it was buried under the courthouse, and nobody knew what I was talking about. I showed him this entry that I read about, and nobody knew about it, and I just couldn't prove it. And then there was another one in close by Redmond about this German princess who lived there at one time, and I just could not find enough information about her to prove it true, or, you know, enough to put it in the book. And several things like that. I mean, and, you know, maybe there'll be a second one. I don't know.
Yeah, there's always a possibility. And if not, some of these could make good plots to other books.
True, true.
Like, I could already picture a few of them being Nancy Drew type stuff.
Yeah, kind of detective, huh?
Yeah, kind of like a little detective novel.
Exactly.
And are you working on more books by chance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always writing. I mean, I write daily. You know, I try to set myself some time to write. I like writing fiction more than anything, but it's a little bit harder to get published.
Understandably.
Yeah, and I'm doing a series of garden articles for the local paper during the spring and summer. As far as these type of books, I haven't really started anything on that yet, though.
And do you think there's a different process with writing fiction versus reality?
Yeah. I mean, because the fiction, it's in your mind, and you just kind of put what's in your head onto paper, and it just kind of go with the flow. And sometimes you might have a good day. Sometimes you've got all kinds of good ideas to write down, and other days you don't have much of anything, but it really doesn't take a lot of research necessarily, as opposed to, you know, one of these books like this. You have to really say, okay, where can I find this, and can I prove it, and, you know, so yeah, it's definitely a different kind of writing.
And I bet it's really fun to do fiction as well as nonfiction, because then you can switch off in between.
Yeah, that's true. That's kind of how my mind operates. I jump around a lot, so it's good to, if I get tired of doing one of them, I can kind of jump to the other one.
Yeah, that seems to be the most healthy process. I tend to do the same thing where I'm like, oh, this one is not really feeling it, so I'll just write this next one.
Yeah, I like fiction a lot. Yeah. I probably read more fiction than anything.
Thank you for sitting in on this interview with me. It was actually pretty nice.
Good.
And I hope you have a really good day.
Yeah, you all too.
That was KBOO News in Depth. Joshua Savage, author of the guidebook Secret Bend, a guide to the weird, wonderful, and obscure. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Kenny.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community